I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We just have too much stuff that's being produced.
Bienvenue dans Onward Fashion, le podcast des solutions business pour une mode durable. Je suis Victoire Sato, fondatrice de The Good Goods, et j'accompagne les professionnels de la mode, du textile et du luxe dans la transformation de leurs pratiques vers plus de responsabilités. Mon job, c'est de rendre visibles les acteurs et actrices de la mutation profonde et au passage, de proposer de nouveaux narratifs. Ici, on restaure le leadership à la française, on met en lumière les innovations qui décarbonent à l'échelle industrielle et on convoque l'humain qui sommeille dans tout décideur pour faire pencher son libre arbitre en faveur de choix qui façonnent positivement le monde de demain.
Good afternoon everybody, thank you so much for attending this conference. My name is Victoire Sato, I'm the founder and CEO of The Good Goods, and it's a major honor to receive today Alden Wicker.
Thank you so much, Victoire. I'm so happy to be here.
Alden, you are an award-winning journalist. You have written investigative pieces for Vogue Business, for The New York Times, for magazines such as Wired. You are also the founder and editor of EcoQuilt, which is the leading international information hub on sustainable fashion.
You made it sound like eco-guilt there. I'm trying not to guilt trip people when I write.
EcoQuilt? How do you pronounce it?
Cult, yeah.
All right, people can check directly with the QR code. You're cordially invited to see how it looks like and sign up for the newsletter. You also do research for a nonprofit organization. And as you seem to have maybe nothing to do on the weekends, you decided to write a book a few years ago that was published in June. Titled To Die For, with a Y. We are going to check this later on. And it's about the dirty list of all the toxic products that we may harbor in our closets. So it's in fact a truth. Most of us are quite used to check now the list of ingredients in our food or in the cosmetic products that we put in our skin. But regarding fashion, we are not quite there yet. In fact, it's probably the worst part of it. The industry itself doesn't know. As a company, probably many of you are from a fashion brand today. Can you tell precisely what's inside the product that you sell? And how far should you regarding the law, which is another important question. And does someone at the fashion brand decide that the performance attributes related to any chemicals worth the potential side effects for the wearer? Today with you, Alden, we're going to explore this vast and quite scary topic, how us as a member of the fashion industry and how us as citizens ended up wearing clothes infiltrated with toxic chemicals and how we can get out of it, if we can.
My pleasure.
So to start with, as you are one of the pioneers on this topic of sustainable fashion, and we had the great pleasure to meet 6 years ago in New York, I would like to share a bit of your journey and toward this specific industry.
Yeah, so actually it's interesting because before I got into the sustainability of fashion, right after college, 2009, 2010, I got really into the sustainability of food. And it was becoming very clear that where your food comes from impacts your health. And how sustainable it is has a direct relation to your health. I'm very happy to be in France because all of our friends talk about how we just feel better when we eat French ingredients because they're so much better produced. And at the time, I started thinking about, well, if it matters where our food comes from, it probably matters where other things that we purchase come from as well. And so I turned to fashion. At the time, nobody wanted to talk about sustainability of fashion. And then Rana Plaza happened, the garment factory collapse that killed over 1,100 garment workers. And suddenly, it was the topic du jour. And so I was writing about fashion sustainability, but for a very, very long time, I could not make the connection between what happens in the supply chain and how that impacts people here in the global north. So it's very hard to keep recentering a garment worker that you'll never meet. I'm sure many of you here have met garment workers, but for the average consumer, it's very hard to continue to prioritize that person you'll never meet, that river you'll never see, all of those things, the invisible greenhouse gas emissions that come out of manufacturing clothing, and all of that. And so it was becoming very frustrating for me because I felt like everybody, of course, yes, of course, I'll pay more for sustainable fashion, but as long as it doesn't cost more, have a lower performance, or look different than my regular fashion. So that all changed in 2019 when I found out that Delta Airlines flight attendants were suing Lands' End, the maker of their uniforms, because they were saying that their uniforms were making them very, very sick. And what they were saying was, you know, it would start with a rash or a chemical burn, and then there would also be a cough or brain fog. They couldn't think. Some of them became physically disabled when they were on the plane with their colleagues or wearing the uniform. And so from there, I had a few questions, right? One was, what is in these uniforms that are making them sick? And two, if this is happening to employees, is it happening to regular people as well? And what I discovered through my research is that yes, I discovered, I think, some of the chemicals that were making these flight attendants sick. And I also found out that yes, it is happening to normal people. It is just harder to pinpoint and identify. But this is absolutely a problem for all of us, not just garment workers.
We'll get back to these Delta Airlines stories in a minute. Before that, I know for a fact that it's super hard to get people convinced about you know, the potential side effects of fashion, and it requires tremendous evidence-based resources. So as we have a very qualified professional audience here, can you share with us maybe the pillar of the way you investigate in general?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a very difficult process because a lot of the people who know most about textile chemistry are not connected at all into the sustainable fashion world or the fashion world in general. So you have actually a lot of researchers at Duke Nicholas School of the Environment, at University of Toronto, at Notre Dame. That's how you pronounce it when you're talking about the American University. And they're all doing this work on the dyes, the per- and polyfluorinated compounds, PFAS, that are found in fashion. And they are not talking to the fashion industry. So it took me a lot of calling and emailing. And at first, in 2019, these researchers were saying, I don't know anything about fashion. I can talk to you about furniture. I can talk to you about all these other things, but I don't know anything about fashion. It's not taken seriously as a research subject. And that actually changed over the next few years. I got back in touch with a researcher, and she said, oh my God, I'm so glad. We just completed 5 years of studying dispersed dyes, which are the dyes that are used on synthetic fabrics, and I would love to tell you about what we found. In addition to that, I interviewed some textile chemistry experts, consultants, but by and large, what I found is that a lot of people who are employed by the industry were either under non-disclosure agreements or were incentivized because of their work to downplay the issue. Oh, it's not a big deal. We're not eating our clothing. You know, the dose makes the poison, right? Like, how do you know we're getting exposed to enough of these things to make it a problem? But so I was talking to researchers. I also started finding people who are affected by this in a really clear way. So I talked to a woman who was a production manager in a series of corporate offices of American fashion brands in New York, and how her health, it started with rashes on her hands. You know, she's opening these boxes straight from India, straight from China, straight from Peru, and she's starting to get rashes on her hands, and she goes to her doctor, and her doctor gives her the whole test, and she's allergic to chemicals used in fashion, and she says, well, I can't do anything about this. This is my job. I can't go naked, you know, these aren't listed on the fashion. All I can see is that it's polyester and cotton. So she keeps going. She gets so sick that she almost dies. She ends up in the hospital. I traveled to India. I spoke to garment workers who had the same thing happening to them. And then there was further research done, like a Harvard study, that showed that unequivocally the uniforms had caused the health symptoms of flight attendants at Alaska Airlines, which is where this first happened. So I had to assemble a lot of evidence from a lot of different disciplines that are not talking to each other in order to put this. I mean, I went to the Newark Airport and Marine Port to see like how customs is dealing with this. I talked to advocates, so it was a lot of different things to put together. And yes, the book went through fact-checking. There's a lot of citations at the back if you would like to look into all of these things. But I think a lot of people are surprised because they're like, how have I never heard of this before? Is this some sort of Gwyneth Paltrow goop fear-mongering that you're doing? Is this misinformation? And no, it's actually just been very well hidden from not only the public, but a lot of people who work in the fashion industry.
So much that, as a matter of fact, we do never seem to learn, and we human beings, way before petrochemistry, have a history of intoxication, various ones, from arsenic to mercury maladies. And well, today we probably read it just as fun facts, you know, historical fun facts, but these are real, right? And probably you can explain what we're seeing behind.
Yeah, so up until the invention of arsenic green, it was very hard to get. There was a reason why only rich people wore green, because it was very hard to do. And so they invented green using copper and arsenic. And it became clear pretty quickly that wearing arsenic is not a good idea. But at the time, you know, you could go to the store and buy rat poison, and it was like it wasn't controlled at all. And so they were using this, and one of the young ladies who was making these green floral headdresses actually died from arsenic poisoning. Now, of course, at the time, you still see this today. There was a lot of jokes made at the expense of not the dye house owners, not the fashion companies or textile companies that are profiting off this, but the dumb women who were stupid enough or irresponsible enough to purchase green dresses and wear them to balls. And so you see this again today, where people attack the low-level influencers who are promoting fast fashion, but they're not getting to the root of the problem of who is profiting off of this. And there was some research showing that when women would wear these dresses to balls, like they would throw off arsenic or they would get rashes on their head, but people just went through with it. And there was some research done and recommendations made, but in the end, it was actually never banned as a color. The industry just voluntarily moved away from it. And when fossil fuel-based dyes, coal tar colors were invented, then everybody moved on to that, achieving green using that that alternative.
And the story repeats itself with a lot of different ingredients that we are using today on a daily basis.
Absolutely.
I like the metaphor of the arsenic lady being the past influencers at the previous era before social media. So back to our airlines attendants. We have on one side, I think it's an ad for the company, and on the other side, one of the health effects of the uniforms. Maybe you can sum up for us the whole story. I mean, it started, you know, with one attendant, then another, but it took some time for them to link, you know, the health issues to the garments. And then what happened with the company and with the supplier?
Yeah, so actually this is, Delta was actually not the first airline that this happened at. So you can see like some of this chemical burn, this rash happening. This first happened at Alaska Airlines with Twin Hill, then American Airlines also with Twin Hill, then Delta, and then at Southwest it's still happening. Southwest has not changed out their Cintas uniforms, even though, again, they're making them sick. So every time a major airline would switch out their uniforms from traditional wool suiting to a poly blend with Teflon, stain retardancy, flame retardants, and antifungals, anti-wrinkles, a significant portion, up to 24% of the airline attendants would start reporting severe reactions. One Alaska Airlines attendant actually ended up passing away 10 years later, and his health started going downhill when he was wearing the uniform, and his surviving partner attributes it to the introduction of those uniforms. The Alaska Airlines attendants initiated a lawsuit. They lost the lawsuit. Nobody knew what was going on. American Airlines attendants, four of them just won a case against Twin Hill, and I think more cases are incoming. So that's good news for the airline attendants, because now we're getting to the point where their story is believed.
So it takes years to get any proof and eventually any positive outcome for the victims.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, why is this happening now? Why didn't this happen before? They have all of the performance qualities, but also airlines are pushing down the price of what they'll pay for uniforms, and that leads to poor quality, sloppy chemical management, and poor quality manufacturing.
And it's probably hard to identify whose responsibility this is. Is it the airline company? Is it the supplier? Is it the dyers, etc.? So do we have any, you know, any info about that? Who is going to be charged?
Yeah, so Twin Hill is the one that is going to have to pay out the settlement. American Airlines will not be held accountable for it, even though they should have known. They saw everything that happened at Alaska Airlines. They received complaints when they did a test run, and they went through with it. But they folded pretty quickly. Within the year, they were switching out the uniforms, and I think they started working with Okotex to have the uniforms tested to make sure that they're fairly safe. Yeah, it's whose responsibility is it? Well, I think it's everybody's responsibility. The dyers need to be using safe chemistry, but if they're not being paid enough to actually engage in safe chemistry or buy certified safe chemicals instead of the cheap chemicals from down the street, how they're going to make the obvious choice is nobody's checking, nobody's getting the things tested. It's also the fashion brands' responsibility for sure, to make sure that what they're sourcing is safe. And also it should be the airline's responsibility as well, but the way the airlines, and also the way these uniform brands would avoid culpability, is they would say, well, tell us the one chemical that is over the limit that is causing all of these reactions. And that is an impossible task. Because, first of all, we don't know all of the chemicals that are in a piece of clothing. It costs thousands of dollars to run a pretty basic panel to see what's in there. It doesn't catch everything. And also, a lot of these different chemicals work together or work synergistically to make problems worse. Or they work on the same organ. Or you have two or three or four different endocrine disrupting or hormone disrupting chemicals on the same piece of clothing, or you have that on different pieces of clothing because you have a whole suit. So that's an impossible thing to do. I think with the American Airlines, the success of that lawsuit, that is falling away and just saying, look, it harmed them. It doesn't matter which chemical it was, it caused harm.
Okay, so for us to understand what we talk about concretely, it takes, you know, tens of steps to create a garment and I don't know, but thousands of chemical products probably inside. So can you present to us as novices the main categories that could be, you know, the most considered as harmful?
Yeah, so I think right now the general agreement is that the most harmful chemicals right now, especially if we're talking about to consumers. Of course, you know, garment workers, dye house workers have it worse, but to consumers, it's PFAS, polyperfluorinated chemicals that are used for stain repellency and water repellency. It used to be that we believed that it was just a problem for the environment when they washed off or you go skiing and they come off your snowsuit. But now we know that they come off, they get into your house dust, they get into your skin. You can breathe them in, you can ingest them. So they're a problem. They're very carcinogenic. They're reproductive toxic, and they are called forever chemicals because they stay around forever. There's other classes of chemicals. There are plasticizers that are used in synthetics, such as phthalates. Those are also hormone disrupting. BPA has been found in spandex, polyester, stretch, workout clothes, socks, sports bras, leggings. That's also a hormone disrupting chemical. Then you also have other performance finishes. I have very serious concerns around nanosilver anti-odor technology, anti-wrinkle or wrinkle-free technologies, usually achieved with a formaldehyde-based finish. And then you have contaminants. So chlordane, which has been banned. I mean, the United States banned a few chemicals in the 80s, and chlordane is one of them. It's an extremely toxic pesticide, and it was found on the American Airlines uniforms, probably because it was used in a warehouse or on a boat and contaminated them. You have antifungals, same story. And then you have dispersed dyes, which are known skin sensitizers. So some people don't react to them, but if you talk to customers, a lot of people will say, I just can't do polyester. It makes me itchy. I think a lot of people don't even know why they have skin problems because nobody's ever told them, have you considered your clothing? They go to the doctor, they say, I'm having skin problems. And the doctor says, okay, what's your lotion? What are your beauty products? What detergents are you using? But nobody really talks about their fashion. So I think there's actually a lot of people who don't realize that their eczema could be exacerbated by what clothing they're wearing as well. I think that pretty much covers it. Yeah.
You mentioned that a few of these toxic products were banned from the US a few years ago, but I'm curious about today brands such as the main one known in ultra fast fashion, I'm not gonna name. I was recently part of a documentary about this, and I had the great opportunity to see the package and to breathe in deeply inside the poly bag. That was just horrible, the smell, and I could definitely tell that I was poisoning myself. But as I don't do this, as a daily routine, so I think I'm fine. What are we likely to find, you know, what are the analysis likely to find in this kind of product? And are some of these toxic products not allowed to get into the USA, but still they do, in fact?
That's a really good question. And it's funny because I also ordered a package from that brand that I'm not allowed to name. And it was one of the things I had tested at great expense. I had 5 things tested. It cost me $10,000, and I got the budget option. So I pulled out a pleather skirt, or as some people like to call it now, a vegan leather skirt. And I handed it to my friend because I was like, this smells so bad. And she started having a reaction to it. And I was like, whoa, I did not expect that to be, it was a crazy moment. So I had it tested, and actually it came in under the limit for everything. They found some things, some chemicals, I don't even remember what their name was, something polydioxide, whatever it was, but it officially came in under the limit, which was really interesting to me because this test is supposed to be the best, but again, there are 40 to 60,000 chemicals used globally in commerce. This test looks at for 130 of them, and a lot of the textile limits that we have are sort of arbitrary, best guesses, industry practice. They're not actually based on fresh toxicology or research. They're just, you know, this is what we use, and so, and they don't, consider how chemicals work together. So to answer your question, what could have been in this package? Anything. Anything. I mean, you could smell it, so it's some sort of volatile organic compound, some sort of VOC. You can't smell heavy metals. You can smell solvents. You can smell plastics, certain plastics, but it could have been anything. The second half of your question, are there chemicals that are banned that are making their way into the United States? Absolutely. We've only banned a few, but they're coming in because we actually don't check. I think some people here have heard of the de minimis standard. So the United States changed legislation a few years back to say any shipment under $800 does not get tariffed. It does not get checked. So you have all of these packages getting shipped one by one straight into the country from the factory, and nobody is looking at them. The only way they would look at them is if they're a children's product, because the United States has banned four chemicals only in children's products, and if they're counterfeit. So as long as it's from a legitimate brand, even if that brand has no chemical management policy, they are not going to look at it. So there is, I mean, you could fill a package with razor blades and ship it to an 11-year-old customer in the United States, and nobody would be the wiser. In the European Union, obviously, there's REACH. They do check some packages. Some packages or shipments are destroyed, shipped back, you know, kept from coming in the country. But there has been recent research showing that there's still hazardous or highly hazardous substances being found in stuff that you can purchase in the European Union. So this is not a problem that has been solved.
It's a bit better, but, you know, the REACH reglementation hasn't been reviewed since 2007, and it's been postponed for supposedly 2024. So I'm not sure that we're really better than the U.S.
Believe me, you are. Almost everybody is better than the U.S.
So, okay, I think that most of the audience here is going to say, well, fine, but I'm not a ultra fast fashion consumer, which I hope you're not. But can we say that the more, you know, the more expensive you pay, the better product you get? Or what about, you know, the bed sheets and the pair of jeans, everything we can buy with anti whatever it is property for an easy care? Is it absolutely harmful, or what's in it?
Yeah, so there's a floor below which you're not going to get safe fashion, right? If you're paying rock bottom prices for something, you're not getting a safe product. It is very dangerous to buy things like, I tell parents, do not buy your children's products off of Amazon. Do not buy them from Shein. It takes an investment, and it takes a little bit of money to ensure that products are free from harmful substances. You need somebody who works in the company, that this is their job. You need testing. You need to pay a few cents more for your products to make sure. You need to have a relationship with your supply chain down to the dye houses. So if you're going for the cheapest price, that's a dangerous choice. That being said, there are several high-end luxury fashion brands that have no chemical management policy whatsoever. And then you have a lot of mid-range brands. They're the worst offenders, especially American brands, the kinds that have been purchased by, you know, hedge funds, and they're just sort of limping along based on their prior reputation. I bought a pair of leather gloves from a brand that everybody here has heard of, and they came back super high for chromium content. They would have failed. But so those seem actually to be the worst offenders, is these like mid-range brands that like literally do not care. They have no sustainability plan whatsoever.
Is this an explanation today on why this is so less regulated, you know, and what's going on toward this regulation? I know that things are moving in the U.S., in Europe as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is an outsourcing problem, right? if you don't know where your clothing is being dyed and finished and by who, where your fabric is coming from, you're going to have a problem. And that's the default right now in the fashion industry. Very few fashion brands know, like, they're just saying, like, I just want it blue and I want it to be high performance, and like you get what you get. You get what you pay for. So that is definitely a big problem. The EPA is moving towards, it's actually, they've started to make some moves to like take a look at vinyl chloride, which is what is made, what PVC is made of. They're looking at 1,4-dioxane, which is a byproduct of polyester manufacturing. But just because the EPA bans a chemical doesn't mean, like, you can still put it on a product and ship it to the United States and sell it to a consumer. Less so in Europe, but there's, you know, there's tons of loopholes. So I do think that's the cynical view. The positive view is that between California and New York, who have both moved to ban PFAS in everyday apparel, and then after that, performance apparel, those are two huge markets. That basically means the entire United States will be moving towards banning PFAS as an entire 12,000 product chemical category. And so we're going to move away from testing for a few types of PFAS, like PFOA and PFOS, and towards testing, like, more comprehensive total fluorine testing. I know I'm getting into the weeds, but I'm very excited about that, because that means, like, if you have to get all PFAS out of your products, that means you have to get to know your supply chain. So I think that's actually going to end up having a ripple effect, where it's not just going to be about PFAS, it's going to be about everything.
And you've been so an activist, it's been years. Would you say that health, which is, I mean, something considered very seriously by the customers, is a new way to leverage, you know, this the efforts and everything that can be made by brands, which is quite new, because when you try to get people having feelings about the supply chain and people like way in the health in the other way of the globe, it's harder to convince them to buy differently. But when it comes to your health, especially your kids, etc., it can be a little different. There is hope for that, no?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is why I wanted to write this book. I didn't want to write just another book about how to shop sustainably. I wanted to look at something new and also say, like, look, like, what is happening to the garment workers is happening to you. You might not realize it because, or what's happening to the flight attendants is also happening to you in a really subtle way. I mean, people are having trouble getting pregnant. We're in a fertility crisis. Eczema is going up. Autoimmune disease is going up. Cancer is going up in 30-somethings, which is super alarming. And now more and more people are saying, like, it is the chemicals, not just people, like researchers, it is pollution, it is chemicals. And you know, what's in the air pollution, which is fossil fuel particulates, is in your clothing as well.
So after all this information, this is the moment we try to cheer up everybody with solutions before we go. So in a very globalized economy, most of the industry, we saw that, doesn't know the deadly effect of, you know, the fashion choices that we do every day. So how can we act concretely at an individual level? Then, second question, as a brand, and the third, maybe for me, as a media.
So I've changed a lot of my thinking around fashion sustainability over the past 10 years. I don't think guilting consumers is working. And I do believe that when you focus on improving your own life and your own community, that is actually the first step. You get instant feedback. And so that's why this is so great. I mean, I would encourage everybody here, if you suspect this is a problem for you or your family, go on a fashion elimination diet. Just dress in natural fibers for a while, avoid the performance fabrics, you know, like, really invest in a few pieces and see what happens. And So that's on an individual level. At a brand level, there's a lot that brands can do. You can get to know your supply chain. You can, you can market this if you are confident. Of course, with greenwashing legislation, there's been lawsuits. You really have to understand what you're talking about, which is why I think it's important for brands that your sustainability head have help from somebody who understands textile chemistry and is not trying to do this all by themselves, and that you really understand this topic. And once you're really confident in that, you can start talking about the health and safety of your product. So you have to go beyond one thing. You can't just say, oh, we have GOTS certification. That's not enough. It is absolutely not enough. I know a lot of customers think it is. It's not. You need multiple layers. So you need to know your supply chain. You need, I would say, work with BlueSign, have things tested by Okotex. There's a bunch of things you should do, and try to figure out how to use more natural materials in your products rather than relying on synthetics, and really think about whether or not the performance that you're supposedly getting from adding these finishes is doing what you want it to do, first of all, and is worth the potential hit to your reputation as it starts coming out about how toxic these things are. Some of my most popular content at this point is people looking for PFAS-free outdoor gear.
And so as a media in general, would you have advice on, you know, how we could share the message and spread the word?
Yeah, that's a good question, because again, it is a very complicated topic and it's very easy to get it wrong. So I would say just as media, we should be really careful about not fear-mongering. Like, I don't ever want to go overboard. So, you know, you'll never hear me say all fossil fuel based things are bad, right? Vaseline is just fine, and it's like pure gasoline, and it has no negative health effects whatsoever. But we don't also want to go in the opposite direction of saying, like, well, you know, until we have the, you know, 10 epidemiological studies showing that when people wear this, they get sick, like, we don't have to do anything. It's really important to name what is happening and encourage the fashion industry to be out ahead of what is inevitably coming, which is more research, more scandals, more lawsuits, more greenwashing, more legislation. This is coming for the fashion industry, and we definitely need to be prepared.
Thank you very much. Last question. What sources would you recommend for professionals that want to learn more ongoing, aside from EcoCult, of course? What are your recommendations?
Yeah, so I really like the work that ChemSec does. ChemSec. They're based out of Sweden. They're really at the vanguard of a lot of this research and advocacy. So I would say sign up for their newsletter, because I find out about things first from them.
Thank you so much, Alden. I think we have time for questions, if there are any. The mic's going to pass on.
Thank you guys so much. So interesting. You both have such interesting careers, and I've been following each of you for a while. My question has to do with NDAs and also censorship, because I know this is a big problem when, in particular, you're looking for resources or even investigating these kinds of problems. Is that something that you've encountered? And if it is, how do you get around it? Are there any solutions?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I've encountered that in a couple ways. So I interviewed somebody who is a textile chemistry expert, and I didn't end up really using any of their interview because, for one, I thought a lot of their information was really outdated and based on, yeah. And the other thing is that they made me sign a long thing about what I could and couldn't say, because they had done so much work with brands that they were under NDA. As well as, Okotex is the best we have, and it is not enough, because Okotex, it is a consumer-facing label, but in the end, their clients are brands. So they're doing all this testing, and none of that information about failure rates or anything is getting out into the public because they have NDAs. So the only time when we hear about failures is when a researcher or an advocacy group spends tens of thousands of dollars to get things tested so that they can show that this is in fact a problem. So that that has been really frustrating. And then the other thing is that the other thing I've encountered is I was supposed to go on a TV show and they canceled like an hour before I was supposed to go on because the lawyers were afraid of litigation from the fashion industry, which I don't think is really a problem, but the chemical industry. So there's, it's the chemical, the makers of the chemicals who are really trying to, like it's scary. They really will go after people who they perceive as potentially impacting their bottom line.
I'm going to join the enthusiasm of this lady over there. Thank you so much. The question that I have to you, Alden, is why do you think of the circular dye solutions coming on the market?
The circular dye solutions? Can you explain a little bit more?
I mean, you know, the dyes pigment. Now we start to find on the market some circular solutions, meaning that...
Like recycled.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that they're very interesting. I think... The bio-based solutions look really interesting. I actually interviewed an Italian maker, and I'm going to forget, Officina 45, plus 45, and they're doing a circular 39. Dye solution.
Officina 39.
39, thank you. And I think that's a really interesting thing. But circularity, when it comes to textiles and dyes, actually can be a really big problem for hazardous materials. H&M and IKEA did a non-peer-reviewed study where they purchased secondhand fashion, not their own, just like from every continent, and they looked to see what was in there because their concern is that if they start recycling stuff back into their supply chains, that stuff, because of everything that's on it, will be over their own limits and they will not be able to sell it because there's so much on there. And so this is actually a circularity problem as well, because as long as you can buy fashion with hazardous substances from some brands, the brands that do have limits will not be able to recycle things through because it's just going to keep all of that stuff on there. So yeah, this is a circularity problem.
Thank you. And I do have another short question. In your opinion, what are the reasons why the countries such as the USA, are not banning more chemicals? Are they political, economical, cultural?
It's political. The chemical, the American Chemistry Association, American Chemistry Council, they are litigious. I think the EPA started to make a determination that formaldehyde is carcinogenic. I know, groundbreaking. And they immediately got sued for making that determination. And so it really comes down to the chemical company. It's in Europe as well. It felt like we were getting close to saying, like, look, PFAS should not be on clothing or in consumer products. And then that was walked back a few months ago because European chemical companies really went hard on lobbying and saying that, we can't give up on PFAS. It's too important.
That slide was actually to highlight the power of lobbies. A question I didn't have the time to ask, so thank you. Is there any other questions in the audience? Or for more?
Hello. Hi. Oh. Just a last question if nobody else.
No worries, we have time.
So I'm the second generation of a textile manufacturing company based in Turkey. And the dyeing techniques is something that I've been closely looking into. And I'm definitely going to buy your book as well to see if there's something else that I can improve or know upon. A few things that I looked upon when it comes to sustainable dyeing, especially in conferences based in Netherlands mostly, was sustainable dyeing techniques. And I'm wondering if I give a couple examples on it, there might be some things you have heard of them, good or bad.
I could try, yeah.
Yeah, so one interesting dyeing technique was based in algae. So using sea-based component materials, algae, right?
I think that one's really interesting. Are you talking about algae-ing?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, so I actually interviewed her, and I thought it was really interesting. She has a lot of lovely pastels. Of course, not all of the different colors yet available, but I do think it has promise.
Yeah. Okay, then the second one that really caught my eye would be, I think it was ColorFix. which is, again, I think it's an American-based company that use bacteria for dyeing. I don't know if you heard of it, and if you have any comments on it, I would love to hear about it.
I have heard of it. I have not myself. I haven't caught up with it, but from what I understand, it's still very much in the development stage. I could be wrong.
Yeah, thank you.
If there are no more questions, I think we can wrap this up. Thank you so much, Alden.
Thank you, Victoire.
Thank you for listening, attending. And I think that Alden will be around if you have some more questions for more shy people.
Merci pour votre écoute. Si vous êtes encore là, c'est sans doute que vous avez apprécié cet épisode. La meilleure façon de nous le faire savoir, c'est de partager ce podcast sur vos réseaux, par email, de bouche à oreille, de laisser un commentaire iTunes 5 étoiles et de vous abonner à la chaîne sur la plateforme d'écoute de votre choix.